supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. A couple of years ago, my dear friend was losing his adult son to cancer. He's a dear, sweet man who could be blustery at times, and he was telling me that at times he was so angry at the injustice about what was happening to his son. But then he said at the same time he was also so grateful for the outpouring of love he was experiencing. When I told him that both emotions made sense, he said, "You don't understand, Dan. My mind keeps darting back and forth between those emotions all day." I asked him if this felt like it was a flashlight darting back and forth. What he said was that was exactly what it felt like. And I said to him simply, "So who's holding the flashlight?" And I watched his body language kind of settle down as he reflected. Whoever is holding that flashlight is called awareness. So many of us spend so much of our lives lost inside of our heads, we're not even aware that we could be the one holding that flashlight. My guest today, Dan Goleman, might suggest that this awareness is the first step towards what he calls focus, which is the topic of his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. Goleman's a psychologist, best-selling author, whose book, Emotional Intelligence, spent a year and a half on the New York Times bestseller list and has really changed the way we think about intelligence and what it really means and what success in life also really means and how to get there. We're really glad to have him with us. Dan, welcome to the show.
Dan, thanks so much for having me.
Boy, we could play Jewish geography for an hour. I have a feeling we know a lot of people.
Dr. Dan G, that's me and that's you.
Right, right. So I'd love to hear from you, our listeners, too. Has your ability to focus suffered over the years? Are you having more difficulty with concentration? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Dan, as I read your books over time, it seems each has evolved out of your work with emotional intelligence. It's over 10 years old now. So, as most of us know, emotional intelligence is a concept that includes concepts like self-awareness, social awareness, self-management. So I wonder, you've been observing this now for over a decade. Have you noticed a change in EQ over the decade?
Well, I don't know about absolute EQ, you know, among the general population, but I do know that the pervasiveness of the understanding there is such a thing is far more widespread. For me, unbelievably, than when I first wrote the book, was actually way back in 95, almost 20 years ago. When I first wrote it, I thought that I would have succeeded if I overheard two strangers where one used the term emotional intelligence and the other one knew what they meant. In other words, it became a meme, an understood concept. And now it's being applied in schools under the framework of social-emotional learning. It's become a standard, gold standard, really, for the active ingredients in leadership and organization. So it really has gotten a lot of traction.
You know, Dan, in our field, there's a lot of good ideas that come down the pike, a lot of interesting, creative, scientifically grounded ideas that come down the pike. We've both seen it, and they seem to go nowhere. This one, it's more than traction. It kind of changed our culture and the way we look at ourselves and each other.
Well, I think it was a very radical idea that you could be intelligent about emotions. You know, we'd put passion and reason as opposing camps in the mind. but actually they're not. They're highly interactive, as you were suggesting in the story about the beam of awareness and where it goes. Where, you know, if we as the flashlight holders beam our awareness in the better place, I would say that's emotional intelligence.
You said in one of your talks about this book that your attention on focus had you rethink the concept of emotional intelligence.
Well, it did, because, you know, I got into writing this book for two reasons. One was that, as you suggest, our attention is really under siege more than ever, I think, in human history, because of digital technologies mostly. And the other hand, in the last two or three years, there's been an upsurge in cognitive science and neuroscience, mm-hmm. studying attention in the brain with brain imaging and so on. So we have a much finer understanding of what's going on in the mind. So, you know, that kind of brought me here.
In your book, and this is what intrigues me here, you talked about two kinds of attention, the top-down and the bottom-up.
Well, top-down is having a choice over where the flashlight goes. It's the part of the brain, we call it executive function, and it is in the top parts of the prefrontal area, really, where we decide, where we plan, where we resolve internal conflicts, where we learn. It's a very important function of the brain. But most of the information processing actually goes on in the bottom-up part of the brain, which is lower down. It's more primitive in evolution. It's where our habits reside. It's where we do things automatically and spontaneously. So that flashlight going back and forth without our controlling it is bottom-up. And if we decide where it should go and keep it there, that's top-down.
That's great. And it sounds so easy, huh?
I didn't say easy.
I say to my patients often, you know, when I tell them about this, I said, you know, the path to well-being, I said, it's simple. It's just impossible.
I would say it's improbable. let's have a little
okay,
hope in there.
Okay. So I want to go back to my friend and the flashlight. So, using the using brain science here, we can talk about the amygdala, which is linked to emotions and aggressions. So we can guess that his amygdala was quite agitated. And when I simply invited him to consider holding the flashlight, everything calmed down. So what was happening?
Yes, and what
physiologically
you're doing is encouraging a very crucial move in the mind. It's really mindfulness. It's becoming aware. We call it meta-awareness, looking at the mind with the mind and understanding where you are now and where you could be, and then the next step is to do something about it. In fact, there was a group at Emory University that did brain scans of people while they're doing something neutral. It wasn't as loaded as that amygdala action in your friend, but it was just keeping their mind on their breath. And then, of course, the mind wanders. That's how the mind is wired. But mindfulness allows us to notice that it's wandered and then bring it back to the breath. And every time you do that, they found the circuitry, the neural circuitry for paying attention, concentrating, keeping it in one place, got stronger. So if your friend can decide where the flashlight goes, that's terrific, because not only will it resolve the angst of the moment, but it's also a step along the way to taking firmer control of our own awareness.
You talked about an article, you cited an article in Science magazine called The Neurobiology of Frazzled. And, you know, I was thinking of that article, and it reminded me of my constant companion, a little fellow I like to call Roger the Ruminator, who seems to be with me.
Well, yes, and rumination is a kind of a tape loop of worry. We all have them, but it doesn't get us anywhere. It's just a loop. Worry has its place. If it gets us to focus on a problem, and come up with some step we can take. If we're just looping, it means our amygdala is running the show, and the amygdala likes to worry, and it's also the source of anger. It's a source of distressing emotions. So if we can notice what's going on, I'm lost in that loop again, that's the mindfulness, then we have a choice point. And I think psychotherapy is wonderful because it helps learn where those choice points are. Otherwise, they just go by and we miss them.
I don't want us to cast dispersions on our poor amygdala. I mean, it's there for a reason. It does serve a purpose, and certainly an evolutionary purpose. We wouldn't be here without it.
No, the amygdala is very important. The amygdala is, for one thing, it's your, the brain's radar for threat. You know, it's asking the question, am I safe? Can I trust this person? That's a very important question in life. It's also not just the source of negative emotions. It's the source of a whole range of emotions. Mm. But it does have the ability, because of the design of the brain, to, when it thinks there is an emergency, to hijack the top-down brain and take it over and run it. This is an amygdala hijack. And in evolution, it was very important because it told us, you know, that rustle in the bush means there's a saber-toothed tiger. We better run. It's what helped us survive. Today, however, as every psychotherapist certainly knows, we're responding with this biological reaction to symbolic threats. And unfortunately, we're relying on overlearned responses, often from childhood, when we get triggered. And so we can have a lot of dysfunctional patterns that actually psychotherapy can be a great help with.
I want to talk about this focus and what we do to change the focus and hold a flashlight back further from the amygdala. You call it exercising the attention muscle. You talk about four steps in the cognitive cycle. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I did mention them. That's that Emory study where you focus on one thing, like the work I have to get done or the person I want to be with, the person I care about. You notice your mind has wandered off, and that act of mindfulness lets you have the choice to bring it back to that work you got to finish or the person in front of you. So that's really the basic move in the mental gym. It's very parallel, actually, to every time you lift a weight in the real gym, you strengthen that muscle a little bit. And the same is true when we refocus our attention, I would say.
It's important to note, Dan, that you're not talking necessarily about sitting on a cushion for a half hour a day. You're talking about living our lives more mindfully.
Exactly. And so one of the, as I said, attention is so under siege these days from distractions, particularly digital distractions. The other day I saw a young mom with a little three-year-old girl hugging her niece who wanted her attention, but the mom was lost in her iPad. You know, that's one of those moments when she could choose to notice, my gosh, you know, there's someone who loves me here and who needs some attention and do something. Or, you know, people at work, there's a diabolical technological paradox going on at work today, and that is the device through which we get our work done, our computers, is also the device that harbors our distractions, all the emails, you know, everything on the internet, the web, the LinkedIn, the Facebook, whatever it is that pulls us away. And so I think more and more of us are fighting this very battle to keep our attention where we want it to be.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Daniel Goleman, and his new book's called Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. If you want to join the conversation, if you've got issues of focus in yourself or your family member, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Randy on the line. Hi, Randy.
Oh, am I okay?
You're okay. Well, we don't know if you're okay. Let's hear your question.
I happen to be at the gym working out, and there's a gentleman here who has increased his body mass by, I'm going to say, let's just say 25%. But when I try to increase my intelligence, my working memory, and all the things like that, I'm not quite sure that I have that room for growth to increase those mental muscles. So could you speak to the practice?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question.
Yeah, and that also that raises questions about our genetics here, Dan. So, Randy, great question. Thanks for the call.
It's a very profound question, really, because one thing we have to acknowledge is that different mental systems have different levels of elasticity. There's a general principle now, what's called neuroplasticity, that the brain redesigns itself. It amps up some circuits, makes them stronger, extends them with new neurons and so on, or diminishes them according to how we use them. The more we use them, the stronger they get. So that's a principle that applies pretty much across the brain. It applies particularly, for example, in the hippocampus, which is a site for memory. It also applies in the prefrontal area, which is this executive center in the brain. But there are fixed limits. So, for example, there is a limit in the pipeline for what we can pay attention to at any one moment. The idea of multitasking, for example, is a myth.
Right.
We can only hold the magic number 7 plus or minus 2 bits of information in mind at one time. That's a phone number, basically. That's working memory, as you mentioned. Working memory does not expand. So that's not something that we can develop. You can't make it 25% bigger. You can use memory tricks that might help you, but it's not the same. We can, however, enhance our concentration, and the circuitry for that, which is very well known now, does build, and it does build very much like a muscle. So I would say be smart about what you try to develop within the mind, but you can do it.
And you can do it through the methods you're just talking about.
Well, this is one of the best researched. I actually have just written an article for the New York Times, hasn't been published yet, but let me share it. It's about mindfulness with attention deficit disorder. This is very interesting because a huge multi-site study that looked at the standard treatments for ADHD found that after two or three years, the medications did not work as well. And so there's a movement within the ADHD research community to look for non-drug interventions. And one of the promising ones now is just what we were describing, the kind of mindfulness training that lets you notice when you get distracted. That's the huge problem in ADD, distractibility, and that you strengthen the mental muscle that brings it back.
I certainly look forward to that article. And, you know, for any of us in the field, you know, none of us are surprised by that. You know, it's just a question of sitting and attending to what's going
on. Yeah, exactly. In a sense, in one way, when you think about it, it's kind of a no-brainer.
I mean,
why not just strengthen the system that is where we have a deficit? In other words, attention. And it's a malleable system. Can be done.
We're speaking with Dan Goleman. His the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and Accenture Institute for Strategic Change have all listed him as the world's most influential business thinkers. His new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence, is what we're talking about today. We're going to take a short break. We're going to take some of your calls. When we get back, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcomes clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and weight management. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Beck Institute proudly supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about focus with well-known psychologist, science writer, Dan Goleman. Dan, I want to talk about young people and technology. At my age, my focus, I've noticed, is significantly impaired because of technology. What about today's children and teens? They're not reading books or even watching television shows because they move so slowly.
I think it's a very important question, Dan. In a way, it's an unintended experiment with an entire world generation. This is the young people today are the first in world history to grow up knowing only a digital world. And we don't know what the long-term impact of that will be. We don't know how their attention will be. We don't know if it will hamper comprehension or maybe develop entirely new kinds of comprehension that, as a result of processing so much information. For me, one of the dilemmas is that so much of what's available in the digital world is junk. It's not quality information. And I worry, for example, about whether kids today will grow up with a good discriminating sense of sound information and information that really you shouldn't trust or which is nonsense or just mere entertainment. You knew when you learned it in school, and it was from a textbook that was based on research and so on, that an idea or theory made sense. But today, online, you just don't know. And that's just one of many things. The other that is in the air quite a bit is, what is this doing to kids' ability to focus? Is it one reason there's so much ADHD being diagnosed? Personally, I think that the upsurge in diagnosis is an epiphenomenon of drug companies, making it a popular answer to problems that have been around for a long time.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree, and that part's getting worse. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Nancy on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there.
So you work with children, yes? You're an OT?
Yes. And in my work with young children as an occupational therapist, one of the things we look at is the ability of a child to self-regulate as a foundation for attention and learning and social participation. And when we look at this overstimulating, this competing information coming in at one time, it's a huge concern. So it's a fascinating conversation to me, because we do look at that smooth transition between those arousal states and the ability to demonstrate adequate, what we call self-regulation. That ability to maintain that level of alertness.
Mm. Dan?
Mm. Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, because self-regulation is another facet of what's called cognitive control. Cognitive control, or executive function, as I'm sure you know, Nancy, is a critical top-down ability that children develop over the course of childhood and adolescence as their brain matures. And it turns out that pretty much the same circuitry, or a very largely overlapping circuitry, controls focusing on one thing, managing impulse, ignoring distraction, and emotional self-regulation. It's kind of a package. And it's one reason that I'm very excited about adding something to emotional intelligence. Dan, I realize it's a question that you asked I never quite answered, but I now see attention as intrinsic to emotional intelligence. And there are now many programs in what's called social-emotional learning that teach the full spectrum of, you know, self-management, self-regulation, empathy, social skill, the panoply in an age-appropriate way to kids with great success, you know, better achievement test scores, the kids are better behaved. Now I think the next step is actually teaching, explicitly helping kids get better and work out the circuitry for focus, for emotional self-regulation, for managing distraction. It's the same circuitry. And I'd love to see integrated into the curriculum from, you know, pre-K up, regular lessons in this circuitry, managing attention and so on.
What would it look like?
I went to a second grade classroom in Spanish Harlem. These are kids that are in very tough neighborhood, broken homes, a lot of problems. These kids were very calm and very focused during the class, and the teacher said it's because of what they do every day. It's a session called Breathing Buddies.
Mm.
Each child goes through a cubby, gets a favorite stuffed animal, lies down on the floor, puts the animal on their belly, and watches it rise on the in-breath and fall on the out-breath, and count 1, 2, 3, breathing in, 1, 2, 3, breathing out. That actually is working out that circuitry, but it's in a very age-appropriate way. And as children got older, of course, you would change what they do. I saw a prototype of a video game that was designed at University of Wisconsin where on an iPad, every time you breathe out, you tap the screen once, and on the fifth breath, you tap it twice, and you get a visual reward, you know, flowers blooming in a desert scene. And as you get better, of course, the challenge, like in any video game, gets better too. And I think those are both very clever ways of getting at this.
Well, listen, Dr. Goldman, sir, you might think breathing buddies are only age-appropriate for younger people, but you damn well better believe I'm taking that back to my office tomorrow. I've got grown-ups that are going to be using breathing buddies.
Well, yeah, that's great, Dan. You're welcome to it, and I'm sure it will help.
Nancy, do you have work with something like that?
Yes, absolutely. We actually incorporate very similar things into our programs for as young as 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, believe it or not. I think that we underestimate the ability of children to learn these and to feel that sense so early on. And so we do incorporate all kinds of strategies and very simple yoga poses, very simple breathing, really the beginning of just what you're saying, that mindfulness education, if you will. And I think it's striking to see how these young children are responding. Not only that, but able to carry it over and sometimes teach mom and dad and siblings, and that's just a wonderful thing.
Wonderful. Nancy, I want to thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
You know, Dan, I'm thinking of this concept of breathing buddies with these young kids, and I do a lot of talks about the concept of disease, D-I-S-E-A-S-E, and how so many of us have disease. But the opposite of that is ease. I mean, that's what we're looking for. You know, everybody's talking about happiness, but we're really looking for ease, just that kind of sense that my buddy had when, if I can be reductionistic, when the parasympathetic system takes over and we go, you know, we're looking for ease, and that's what's happening with those children.
And, you know, I have been interested in this for most of my career as a psychologist. I actually did my dissertation way too early on meditation as an intervention in stress reactivity, which is really about how do you get from sympathetic arousal to parasympathetic arousal, you know, in quick, easy steps, so to speak. And I found personally that's one way. I start my day with a meditation session, then I do my writing because I'm clear and calm. And I think that any way we can find, it might be yoga, it might be muscle relaxation, whatever it is, if we make a daily ritual of it, it helps us get into that state of ease. I love the concept.
Hmm. Let's take another phone call before we have to go to break. We've got Carol on the line. Hi, Carol.
Hi, both Dr. Dangies. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question concerning dealing with teenagers and this whole thing of focus, and especially around technology. You know, I've noticed that my daughter's in eighth grade, and they're starting to use the computer more for homework and the like, and her homework time has increased drastically because she's so distracted by everything else on that computer, and it's become a source of negativity for us. So I need some positive ways of helping her to refocus herself, because it's become very negative, and this is their life. They've got to deal with this from now until forever.
Let me suggest two things. First, there are apps that will turn off everything but what she's doing. You can't access the internet for this period of time. I don't know the names of them, but they're out there. That's one thing. The second is, you know, when I wrote the book Focus, that was the why to. The how to was a series of instructional audios I've done. There's one cultivating focus for adults, but there's one focus for teens and a focus for kids. You might just give your daughter focus for teens and see if she uses it. You know, coming from you, it's a little difficult, but she might just like it. It's available for More Than Sound, one word, morethansound.net. And or if there's a local you know, center that offers such things for teens, that would be great too, because then she'd have, you know, peer support. But anything you can do along those lines, I think, might help her.
Okay. Thank you. And Carol, that's morethansound.net?
Morethansound.net, yes.
Okay.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. Dan, before we go to break, I've got a question about an issue in my life. I have a little five-year-old in my life named Jacob, and he is very much in love with Star Wars. Wait a minute, Angry Birds Star Wars, but so much in love that it's tough to get the iPad away from him. You said there were apps that you use for your grandchildren.
Well, the app I use with my grandchildren was the one I described. It's that game Tenacity, which is a training in focus. You can get that app, and if he gets addicted to that, actually, that's a positive addiction.
Mm.
And then there's the more general principle, which is speaks to another way to improve the circuitry for managing impulse and emotions and so on. It's the equivalent of the famous marshmallow test, where four-year-olds were told you could have one marshmallow now or two if you wait till I get back from running an errand, which psychologist Walter Mischel did years ago. Legendary now.
Classic, yeah.
But, you know, the everyday equivalent is, you know, do the thing you have to do first, and then you can have Angry Birds.
Yeah, that's what we've been doing lately, and it seems to be helping a bit. Listen, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about leadership and what's empathy got to do with it anyway.
Good question.
We're talking with Dan Goleman. His one of his original books was Emotional Intelligence. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for a year and a half. It's been translated into 40 languages. His new book is Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. We're going to be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking with Dan Goleman about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. So before we took our break, I brought up the whole issue of empathy, and that's certainly tied into emotional intelligence. Hard to get by in life if we don't have that.
Well, yes, empathy is critical for rich relationship, for business. You brought up leadership. By the way, I have to disavow being seen as the most influential business writer. I'm sometimes rated among them. But anyway, I do think about it quite a bit. And I recently wrote, actually in the Harvard Business Review, an article which won their, it's called the McKinsey Award for the best article of the year, rather to my astonishment, but that's being announced tomorrow. I wrote, among other things, about three kinds of focus, and within the second, which is focus on other people, I note that there are three kinds of empathy, each important in different ways. One is cognitive empathy, where you understand how the other person thinks, how they see the world, helps you communicate well with them. You can put things in terms they understand. It's very important for human relationships generally, but particularly for leaders. The second is emotional empathy, which is an immediate resonance. You feel what the other person is feeling. It's chemistry. It's being simpatico. Those operate on different circuits in the brain. If you have only cognitive empathy and you don't really care about the other person, you can be a sociopath. You can be a son of a bitch at work, the guy that nobody wants to work for, a bad boss. The third kind of empathy is an inoculation against that. It's empathic concern. In empathic concern, you not only understand how people feel, how they think, but you care about them. You want to help them if they need help. And I actually argue that the best leaders, the best bosses, have empathic concern and show it to the people that work for them.
I see a unhealthy, a dark side of that in my office, about people who can feel others, significant others, peers, colleagues, and do have a concern about them, but tend to be overreactive and selfless about it.
Yeah, and I you see that pattern also, Dan, in the caring professions. So, for example, among nurses who get overwhelmed by the pain and suffering of their patients, those are the ones who tend to burn out. And the part of emotional intelligence that typically is underdeveloped in people like that is what we talked about earlier, emotional self-regulation. You're so receptive to other people's emotions that you take on all the negativity. You can't metabolize it. You can't manage it yourself. I think if you can do both, then you've got a good thing going.
So what you're suggesting here and what we know about is that our brain is a social organ, and we're knowing more and more about the value of social networks and the whole concept of collective intelligence.
Yeah, and in fact, this started. I did a book, wrote a book about 10 years ago called Social Intelligence, and it was about the discovery of the circuitry you're talking about. And it happened when brain scientists stopped looking at one brain and one body and one person and started to look at two brains and two bodies while people interacted or simulated interactions. And they discovered, lo and behold, there was unknown circuitry in the brain, and it was designed exactly for what you're talking about, tuning into the brain of the person we're with and creating a brain-to-brain network that keeps us on the same page, that keeps us linked, that creates that resonance that makes relationships so rich.
I watched your talk at Google, and I loved your line, death by PowerPoint. I mean, that's a lack of empathy. I also love when leaders and CEOs spend thousands of dollars and bring in outside consultants with lots of whiteboards and exercises. And the bottom line is, when they're done, everybody has a new bumper sticker or a phrase that the organization uses for a few weeks.
That's right. Some hollow mission statement or, some solution. That's right. And what's going on there is, it's kind of a sham. The real deal is true resonance and true connection. And I think that, 100 consultants won't help remedy that unless it's there.
Can it be built in? How do you change a culture of an industry or an organization?
Well, it's tough, but it definitely can be done. I've seen it happen in organizations, and one of the key things is that it has to be like the brain, both top down and bottom up. What I mean by that is that, if you bring in those consultants and they leave the slogans behind and show the PowerPoints that bore people to death anyway, that's the death by PowerPoint is boredom. It doesn't really do anything. But if you have the opposite, where something is actually truly put in place from the top down, where a boss, a CEO, for example, says, this is important and embodies it, then you're going to have a change that has a chance. On the other hand, it has to be a change that people really want, that people resonate with. People say, you're articulating a vision of what life could be like here that I buy into. And so I want to make the change. So it takes a couple of things. It takes a leader who shows this matters, but also who's bringing in a culture change that people want, that people resonate with, from the heart to the heart.
Well, the research on psychotherapy shows that it doesn't work unless, the patient buys into the therapist model.
Yeah, you need a working alliance. You need to feel, this is someone who can help me, who I trust, who I can be open with. And if you don't have that, if you don't feel that what the therapist is offering is what you need, then you need to keep shopping for a therapist, I would say.
Exactly. Well, I've been hogging you a great deal, and there's a bunch of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Morris. Hi, Morris. Morris?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to... First, I wanted to say that I love your work on emotional intelligence, but I would like you to address creativity. I'm a portrait painter, and it takes a tremendous amount of focus to do an excellent portrait, but at the same time, you're just a technician. If you can't relinquish that focus and how would you know what to put in the background? I've seen dancers who know every step, hundreds of steps, they're doing it correctly, but they just don't feel the music. They won't allow themselves to loosen up, and it seems like it's not seeing the forest for the leaves.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Morris. I write about creativity and focus, and we've been talking about focus as though it were only concentration. I think actually concentration may be a bit overvalued, because the opposite of it, letting go, letting your mind wander, is when creativity occurs. You're not going to bring together two novel elements that have never been combined in this way, that are useful, which is a definition of a creative act, unless you open your mind and let go of that one point of concentration. There's a classic model of creativity which says, start with immersing yourself, concentrating, gather information as widely as you can, and then if you don't come up with something right away, relax, go for a walk. It's often the annals of science and math are full of moments where that math problem that the guy struggled with for 3 years, he solved, when he was walking along a beach. That's how the mind is. You need that bottom-up part of the mind, which associates much more widely than top-down. And I think that you speak to someone who knows only the technique in an art and doesn't open up. I think you want to master the technique to the point where you don't have to think about it, and then let your mind roam. That's when the creative moment is going to come. That's where the feeling comes from.
I would also want to suggest here that, you know, my friend, back to the flashlight, you know, this wide focus is about context, but it's also a very good exercise, like Morris was talking about, is a narrow focus. And to be able to go back and forth, you know, to be able to look at a spot in front of you and see everything you can find about it is great, but, you know, the mind fatigues. You know, and then just to rest and open and
well,
see
that's
the world
another
around
thing. All the that's important, too, actually, is that the concentration fatigues the mind. It actually burns up the brain's energy source, glucose. And if you get to the point where you're just treading water, you should go out for a walk. You know, take a break. People who are working at computer screens, for example, and myself included, often forget. You get so absorbed in what you're doing, and then you realize you're not getting anywhere. That's when we need to, like, you know, give ourselves that break that's going to reinvigorate us.
And this sounds precisely what a good leader needs to do.
Huh? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or a good parent.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. See the larger context. I want to talk about empathy in business. And these days it seems more difficult with all the pressure of business, even medicine, to achieve and produce. And the bottom line, these days business and medicine is judged by the bottom line. Who has time for empathy? And who pays
for it?
We
have to watch out. Dan, I think it's so important because the accountant's mentality is taking over, which just looks at the numbers and doesn't look at the people involved. You know, with the computerization of medical records, something really, I think, a little diabolical is happening, which is you can hardly make eye contact with the physician or nurse anymore during an interview. You know, they're looking at, I was at the doctor the other day, and the nurse was asking me all these questions to, you know, so the doctor would have them, and she was looking at a computer screen, not at me, through the whole time.
Right.
She didn't look at me once, actually. Then as she leaves, she said, well, nice to see you. I had to laugh. She didn't see me at all. And I think the same is true in the business setting for other reasons, and that is that people are more pressured than ever. They're expected to do more with less. There's more incoming stimuli and more. People are more tightly scheduled, and it seems like, or can seem like, a waste of time to just stop and give full attention to the person you're with. But those are the moments, those really connected moments, when magic happens, when you really have a communication that, you know, you really understand what the person is saying, and you say something back that has impact. Otherwise, it's just all on the surface, and I think it trivializes interaction.
Boy, it sure does. I hope, you know, we get a wake-up call to this because, you know, productivity, you know, at one level it might be up, but, you know, so is depression and stress and overall unhappiness. I want to quote something by somebody we could argue is a pretty good leader, and that's the Dalai Lama.
And I think he's the best myself.
Yeah, he's really not bad. Anyway, he suggests these self-questions. He says about our motivation for doing anything. Is it just for me, or is it for others? Is it for the benefit of the few or the many? Is it for now, or is it for the future?
Well, I actually end the book with that quote, and I do it because I think he is upping the ante for us all.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we operate daily in this society on a set of values that are implicit assumptions about what matters that we don't really look at or question. But they've gotten us into huge messes, you know, the banking scandal of 2008, a planet on a slow-motion suicide to ecological breakdown. And it's because of, you know, rampant greed, essentially, and self-interest as the primary motivating factors. I think as a society we have to take a bold look at what's driving us and rethink it. It's just not working.
Well, I think small, because I'm just a little clinician, and you know, we know about all this research about well-being, happiness, and old age, that it's about, A, it's about relationships, B, it's about living a life of meaning, that you know, doing every day something that's consistent with your deepest values. And so many people don't even know what they are anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe one of the main causes of what you call dis-ease, that we're not at ease in our lives, and part of it is this misalignment of what we do with the values that matter to us.
Yeah, you know, you talk about our greed, and, you know, and it looks like greed. I read it as kind of a desperate hunger for, but fill in the blanks, we don't even know what we're hungry for. And I think that's the question. We are hungry, but what for really?
That's exactly the question we need to ask ourselves, Ben.
Yeah. It sounds like you've gotten some answers. You're pretty clear about what your life is about, and you're living your life pretty consistently.
Well, you know, it can always be better. I don't ever present myself as a model of how to live a life.
Oy vey, you sound like my mother now. It could always be better. rest, Dan, rest. Enjoy. Now I hope I sound like your mother.
I wish you did.
I had that feeling. Well, listen, I've so enjoyed spending this hour with you, and I know our listeners have also.
It's a real pleasure. I really enjoy being on this show with you, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks so much for the work you do. We've been talking about focus with psychologist, science writer, Dr. Dan Goleman. Well, to download our podcasts, go to whyy.org/voices. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. I've got some new interesting things on my webpage. Take a look. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. Oh, me. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, please enjoy your week, my friends.
You're listening to